Well, first today, an apology for trying to say too much yesterday. And for rushing things so terribly at the end, I promise you, however, that when I give you the exam on Friday, that I won't emphasize that stuff I rushed over yesterday. I should have stuck, and maybe I will today, to the 50-word Bible. Have you ever heard that? Well, at least two or three of you haven't, so let me read to you the 50-word Bible. Here we go. God made, Adam bit, Noah arced, Abraham split. Jacob fooled, Joseph ruled, Bush talked, that's the burning bush. Pharaoh plagued, sea divided, tablets guided, promise landed, judges led, Saul freaked, David peaked. Kingdom divided, prophets warned, people exiled, hope rose, Jesus born, God walked, anger crucified, love rose, spirit flamed, word spread, God remained. Yeah. Well, we do have to get from Genesis to Revelation this morning, but that Bible helps us do it a little more quickly. We are doing all the promises of God and God's yes in Jesus Christ, and today the promises of God that are related to food and to eating. The title up on the kiosk, as Tom read it in announcements this morning, is God Promises Plenty for All to Eat, but the brokenness of bread breaking is only fixed through the breaking of bread with Christ, as we shall see. The promises in the scriptures concerning food and eating are of a somewhat different kind than those related to Israel's election as God's people, or the promises of land and king and temple. But promises about food are all through the scriptures, maybe because food and eating are obviously matters of life and death. And the ways in which we get food and share food are uniquely human. The meaning of food is very close to the secret of the meaning of life itself. Breaking bread together has always been and remains something so much more complex and meaningful than merely fueling ourselves for another few hours of work. Moreover, we human beings have broken the breaking of bread, and it needs redeeming. And in multiple ways, God promises such a redeeming, and so we'll look this morning for God's yes to the promise of redeeming our breaking of bread. Over the years, there's no doubt been plenty of talk, especially up here at Holden Village, that God's gift of food to humankind seems to be, at least at the beginning, quite strictly vegetarian in both Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And listen carefully. This is the one from Genesis 1. God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath and life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. So everybody gets plants, but no creatures that move about on the earth get to eat each other. Genesis 2. "And the Lord commanded the human being, 'You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall die.'" Nothing about eating anything except the fruit from plants. Soon thereafter, we witness the very first meal in the scriptural tradition, the one at which the man and woman eat fruit from the forbidden tree, and with that, everything is broken, including food and eating. It's true, as we keep on reading, through the scriptures that we see marvelous meals of hospitality. Abram and Sarah entertain the three strangers who show up to visit in Genesis 18, and what a feast they spread, complete with bread made from three ephahs of flour. And if you're an aficionado of such things, you know that three ephahs of flour is 36 liters. That's Holden-style bread. But in addition to such marvelous hospitality, we also see stories about how the lure of food, a bowl of pottage, brings Esau to lose his birthright. And with the trickery and the treachery of yet another meal served up by Jacob to his father pretending to be Esau, the latter loses the promise of blessing as well as his birthright. So food unites us, but food also divides us. Or rather, we use food to bind ourselves to others, but we also use food to break the world into cliques and classes, into groups of insiders and outsiders. When we are desperate, we cry out to God, and God gives us our food in due season. Or in the case of the wilderness generation, God gives us our food for a whole lot of seasons, a whole generation. They ate manna, which means in Hebrew, what's that? It was the food of promise, but they didn't know what it was, and eventually they despised it. But one thing stayed the same. They didn't know what it was, but it was always enough. But even out there, there was one amazing feast in the wilderness, the one reported in Exodus chapter 24, verses 9 and following. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. Under his feet there was something like a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. God did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God, and they ate and drank. Now there's a banquet for you. But mostly the stories of meals are a tangled mess of curse and blessing. This week's lessons have given us a meal of hospitality, but a broken one, because it's one at which a rich man serves a poor man's lamb that he has stolen and slaughtered. And at another meal of hospitality, disdain and judgment poison the food. And even some of the texts in which God promises the great and final feast have a spooky side. I have always loved this text. We read it at Easter. We read it a couple of other times in the lectionary. I have used it at funeral texts. Isaiah 25. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines made clear. And he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all the nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his peoples he will take away from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken. It will be said on this day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. What a wonderful scene. The ultimate banquet at which we shall all eat the promised feast together, have our tears wiped, the shroud of our sadness lifted forever. But we always stop at verse 10. And if we kept going, we would get the rest of Isaiah's vision of the great and final feast. And here's how it continues. But the Moabites shall be trodden down in their place, as straw is trodden down in a dung pit. Though they spread out their hands in the midst of it, as swimmers spread out their hands to swim, their pride will be laid low despite the struggles of their hands. That always wrecks the flavor of the food. At least for me, there's a funny smell coming from down below. That dream meal requires someone on the outside, some enemy left to starve, someone we hate because they have been against us, must swim in the urine that flows down the hill from our feast, the leftover of our fine wines. To this feast, Satan invites Jesus. When in the story of the temptation that we read in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, the tempter offers Jesus the kingdoms of the world if only he'll admit that power and intimidation are the only ways to have and to control them. But bread is a part of that conversation too, we recall, because you could fix the world with bread, the tempter suggests. Turn stones to bread and everything else that we need, and the world will be fixed. No one will ever starve again. No one will ever need to fight someone else for food. There will be no need for a bottom of the mountain, because everyone will have enough. But Jesus doesn't believe that. He says no to this tempting banquet, and he heads in a different direction, toward a different kind of feeding and a different kind of ruling. He heads directly into a world where bitter and bloody feasts remain all too common. He hears, for example, of a banquet much too close for comfort, the great celebration of Herod's birthday party reported in Matthew 14, the one at which the dessert for the grand feast turns out to be the head of John the Baptist on a platter. This is just a repeat of Isaiah's feast in the picture that I read. This is our favorite human feast. This is our great yes, to have not only a celebration of our life, but to have the head of our critic, our nemesis, our ex-spouse, our enemy, political or otherwise, on a platter. And we will get vindication. We love that dessert. It is our yes. Well, immediately upon hearing of that dinner in Matthew and Mark, Jesus withdraws, and he goes into a lonely place. And the word is the word for wilderness. And there we read of a scenario in which one of the great promises of God is fulfilled. As Jesus feeds 5,000 men, not counting the women and children. Exactly as this kind of thing is described in the old story, back in the book of Numbers. At this feast, out in the wilderness, where there is simple bread and a little fish, all are welcome. No one's head is on a platter. And even more importantly, there are leftovers. This is the Messianic feast. But it's much more than bread. As the Johannine version in John 6 of this same story, the only miracle story that's in all four Gospels, by the way, as John explains, it's living bread. For the food that Jesus really gives somehow in this meal is really himself, his body, his blood, his life, given for, and as we confess, given into the likes of us, this meal is our feast on the holy mountain. There is one more feast at the end of the story, the one with the risen Christ, the one reported near the end of Luke. After the Emmaus pair headed home in great disappointment, having witnessed one more time when someone had to die so others could celebrate. After their long conversation on the road with a stranger, in which they wrestled mightily with the promises of God and what those promises may or may not mean, this pair finds in the breaking of the bread that they have entertained not only an angel unawares, but the risen Christ himself. In the breaking of the bread, they recognized him. And then they realized their hearts had burned already on the road as they examined the scriptures with the person who had joined them. And from then on, that's where they and we have always found the risen Christ, in the breaking of the bread and in the study of the scriptures using the hermeneutic Jesus teaches them out there on the road. But of course, none of this would have happened except they invited a stranger in off the road to eat with them. And so we find the Christ in that way too, in hospitality to the strangers. Now, do you want to know how big a deal this meal was? What all gets redeemed there at that table in Emmaus? Luke says, when that stranger broke the bread, their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And Luke, very deliberately, I believe, uses the exact words of the Greek version of Genesis when it describes the effects of that first meal ever, the one which we began a few moments ago, the meal that broke all our meals ever after and all of our eating at the very beginning. Because there, another pair of human beings wrestled over the words of God with a third party, and over what God meant when God promised this and that. They ate, says Genesis, and their eyes were opened, and they recognized that they were naked. Only this time they recognize something else, something that not only covers their shame, but redeems every other meal. The simple meal that we share, and all the others affected by and transformed by it, up here or down from the mountain, where we practice hospitality and forgiveness, all those meals, like that Emmaus meal, become the antidote for broken bread breaking. They become God's ultimate yes to the promise that one day there will be a feast for all peoples. And God will wipe away everyone's tears, and there won't be anybody at the bottom of the mountain fighting for life in our dung pit. We await that day. We have glimpses of it up here. For the moment, we can't always get everybody up on top of the mountain, so we mostly need to have the party down at the bottom, in the dung pit and the latrine, where we live and work and find our calling among the lonely and the broken and the left out. For now, that's also where our friend, the crucified one, promises to eat and to drink with us and to find his family, those whom he calls his own. So, dear friends down here at the bottom of the mountain, bone appetit. On the holy mountain or in the dung pit, party on.